This is Kate Swanell, Engagement Editor with the Medical Journal of Australia, and today our special guest for our podcast and video is Professor Brendan Crabb, who is Director and CEO of the Burnet Institute in Melbourne. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you, Kate.
You've co-authored a perspective for our 16th of February issue about the Medical Research Future Fund and its importance regardless of its political state, so to speak. Tell us a little bit about why you think it's a vital part of research in Australia in the future.
Well, the Medical Research Future Fund quite simply does two things. It's designed to double the annual commitment from the federal government to medical research, which is major, yep. over a decade, but a steady increase to a doubling over what's there now, from $1 billion approximately to $2 billion a year. The second thing is because it comes in the form of disbursements, interest payments, if you like, from a fund, it's effectively into perpetuity, you know, notwithstanding some uncertainty over these wealth funds every now and again. It creates more certainty than there was in a system where we go cap in hand, more or less, you know, in a budget cycle. So, you know, from both of those perspectives, it's a very good thing, the Medical Research Future Fund. And the controversy has only been wrapped up in how it's to be funded. It has never been controversial, the fund itself, and that it's a good idea, and that it's going to, you know, make a really significant difference to sort of health and wealth in Australia. No one that I've spoken to has seriously questioned.
Are you confident that the future of the fund doesn't rest with the co-payment issue or with any other political happenings that may occur in the next 6 months, 6 to 12 months?
I am confident of that. I think that we've come a long way from May last year when it was announced, and the two were tied together, you know. And you can understand why, if you announce a new funding commitment, you want to announce how that's going to be funded. And so I can understand how that happened, but of course it was tagged to something that was so controversial that the fund, I think, primarily was simply lost, simply not talked about. You know, here we were in a May budget, an austerity-driven budget that we all knew was going to be austerity-driven, lots of tough things in it. And there was at least one, but probably only really one, absolute shining light, positive thing, and that was the Medical Research Future Fund. Really hardly talked about it. And I understand why that was the case, but since that time, you know, we and others have done a lot of work to make sure that people understand the benefit of the fund, just purely from the benefit of the fund's point of view. And I think that's included all of the stakeholders, all the MPs, upper and lower house, all the parties, including their own party who came up with the idea. And I think, at least might be a wishful thinker, but that's made it really part of the lexicon. And I'm very hopeful that no matter what happens with respect to funding, that we'll have a Medical Research Future Fund. There's another very important factor, and that is it's going to be funded from many different savings. There's up to $1.5 billion that's already there. The fund itself isn't created, but some of the savings that are already approved or were there, for example, the leftover $1 billion or so from the Health and Hospitals Fund, is there. So there's funds already to put into a fund, should it be established. So I think given that it's become such an accepted good thing across the Parliament and I think to a reasonable degree the public, and because there's some money there, the chances that we have a fund, I think, are very strong. The concern is the scale of the fund.
Yeah,
it's a fund. It's not the disbursement. So the fund is not what medical research gets. You know, it's a savings for government. So the $20 billion seems like a lot of money. It is a lot. Of course, it's an awful lot of money. But that's not money for medical research. What's money for medical research is the interest payments on that, estimated to be around 5% or $1 billion a year. Now that, over a decade to build up to that point, takes medical research funding from what it is at the moment, about $850 million a year, will take it to approximately double. If you imagine that that 850 grows a little bit as well over the next decade, then the extra billion takes it to $2 billion a year and doubles. So that's where the figure of $20 billion is so important, because That growth is fantastic growth,
yep.
But it's not out of this world growth. What
yes.
we can strongly argue, we as a sector, as a broader health sector, not just the research sector, argue is necessary to address the issues that we have, and chronic health issues, for example, yep. in Australia, and to take advantage of the opportunities that are there for economic development. You know, we have a very significant export industry already, $4 billion a year, through effectively health and medical research products. And so, you know, that is the economy of the future, as well as responding to our health needs. And so it does need to grow substantially, and doubling over a decade is about right. It's doubled before yep. under Howard and Abbott.
Yep.
And, you know, the payoff is there for everybody to see. So substantially less than $20 billion leaves us with nothing like the windfall
yep.
that perhaps people imagine with yeah. a big number that it might appear, because it is not what comes to medical research, it's just the interest payments.
Where does that put Australia in terms of world-class research spending?
At the moment, we're at about two-thirds mm-hmm. of the OECD average. So while we clearly have a strength in health and medical research,
yes.
you know, Australia, especially at a discovery end, and we can debate a little bit about how well we translate those discoveries into products. Great examples of where we do it brilliantly,
yeah.
Gardasil, for example. But you know, we're probably better at the discovery end than translating. But we do have an enormously high and well-justified reputation for health and medical research. So to be only at 60% of the OECD average suggests that we're punching above our weight, as they say, but also suggests that we've got some room to move. Now, doubling the fund over the next decade will bring us about to that average. So by no means will we be an outlier as some sort of crazy high supporter of health and medical research. That's not the case.
It seems to me to be very hard to be a research scientist these days. It seems to be a very hard thing to do, to get funding and to hold on to funding. Will the Future Fund make that easier? Do you think it's too hard?
Yeah, I do. In short, I do think it's too hard. I mean, it needs to be competitive.
Yeah.
It needs to be tough, and it needs to be difficult. This is an international playing field. There's nothing local about health and medical research. Doing the best stuff and the best stuff in the world, you can't be in it. So it inherently does need to be competitive. There isn't anyone who thinks, though, that we haven't gone too far in that. We run the risk now of, and we're already seeing it, we run the risk of our top people or otherwise really talented people who should be choosing health and medical research, whether they be clinical researchers mm. or from a science background or from a social science background, who should be choosing health and medical research as their career, saying, I don't think so. I've got options, or I will choose it, but I'm going to a place or to a country where the funding is a little more secure. So with success rates, for example, within the NHMRC project grant scheme, now down around 15%, you know, probably in the order of half of where they need to be. You know, you don't want it to be easy to get a grant. You certainly don't want it to be almost impossible and a bit of a lucky dip to get a grant. And that just can become so discouraging, to the point where you either get out or you spend in the order of 3 months a year with your grant applications. Now, grant applications are a good thing. They yeah. help you hone what it is and plan very carefully what you propose to do. But again, it's too much. You shouldn't be spending 3+ months on the application. You should be spending most of your time on the work,
yeah.
of course. Now, this isn't just senior people. This is your average postdoctoral scientist looking to become an independent career person or early career stage scientist, who really do need to be concentrating on their work and their ideas that have got them to this position, not spending such a proportion of their working day and working week on worrying about where next year's funding's coming from.
Is the system biased towards older, already published scientists?
My own personal view is it's not particularly biased. There's it's an area that where there's been substantial effort to ensure that the early career scientists are have opportunities. I think it's tough for everybody. I really do think it's tough for everybody. I mean, if you've got an established career that's really strong, obviously you look good from a funding agency's point of view, but many schemes are not open to you because they're only open to more junior researchers.
Right.
I think it's tough. It's very tough for junior researchers, but it's tough for everybody. They've just got the added crystal balling to do. They've got to look ahead and go, where's that going? Do I really want to have that uncertainty?
Yeah.
It's the uncertainty for my entire career. The older scientists might recognise that it comes in fits and starts a little bit, and so they'll ride this one out. And I think it's more that than any sort of old boys' club.
Yeah.
I mean, I really don't think that that's where we're at the moment. Without improvements can, of course, be made, but that's by no means the primary concern. It's really the lack of funds.
Yeah. Let's narrow it a little to the young medical doctors out there, the trainees, the registrars, the medical students thinking about it. Why is it a good idea for younger doctors to be involved in clinical research projects? Why is the research part of it important?
Because they'll be better doctors,
yeah,
for starters. They don't need to have any great vision about what they can contribute to research. By immersing themselves in it, and there's no way to really properly understand research, the research paradigm and what it brings, unless you actually have a go at it. So, you know, the more clinicians or people in training for clinical work or associated activities, the more they do some research, even if they've got no intention of that being their, a mainstay of their career, the better they will be at their job. So that's the first reason. I think the second is that the research that actually is done benefits enormously from people who are also at the coalface, you know. So
yeah,
not by two separate entities, but by a mixture. The very same person who's seeing patients,
mm-hmm,
is actually going back into the laboratory or into field-based research with teams trying to come up to answers for those things. Now, I don't think you need to be tremendously psychoanalytical to work out. That's a really good circle.
Yeah.
It makes the research very focused on the problems that are really there. And thirdly, they're just some of the most talented people in the country, if not the most talented people in the country. Therefore, they need to do the research, and the research will benefit enormously from that talent.
Are enough doing it?
Nowhere near enough are doing it, and you can understand why.
Yeah, because it's tough.
It's tough. Opportunities aren't really necessarily as readily there as they should be.
Yeah.
I think the good part is that the relevant authorities are conscious of that. I think the review of health and medical research done by Simon McKeon of,
mm-hmm,
now a couple of years ago,
yeah,
that's had tremendous traction, addressed that front and centre. And, you know, those recommendations are starting to trickle through. They've had, to a degree, been taken up by the current government, even though they weren't the ones that commissioned the review. So I think that the problem's being recognised. Some of the solutions have been identified. But we still have a major challenge to implement that. And, you know, the answer is both money and policy. I think we've actually got a lot further down the track with policy. So the final part to that, the answer to have more clinicians or more clinically orientated people in research involves, you know, both policy,
yep,
and money.
Yep.
And through Simon McKeon's review and through governments, both previous and this one's responses to it, and the sectors, we think we've got policy, or at least the framework that will address that issue.
Terrific.
We don't yet have the money.
Yeah.
And the Medical Research Future Fund, although it's not yet earmarked as to exactly how it would be spent by any means, but it obviously provides those funds. And so I don't think we're far off having a circumstance under which it's much more attractive for clinically orientated people to do research.
Let's talk about the Burnet Institute for a minute. When we talked a couple of weeks ago, you said one of the things you were proudest of was the shift in focus of the Institute that you've managed to oversee over the last 7 years. Can you talk a little bit about that and what the focus is at the moment?
Sure, I can. Well, look, when I arrived, we were a merged institute.
Yeah.
the Mathalamburn Institute for Medical Research and Public Health on the one hand and the Austin Research Institute on the other. Two institutes with a proud history and their own research programs. And, you know, at that time the need was just there to say, well, what was this new institute, which was retained the name the Burnett Institute, going to hang its hat on? Mm-hmm. You know, what was its niche? What was our special capacity to make a contribution? And, you know, the decision I made, of course, with my executive team here and the board, was to have a single focus on not so much a disease or a health issue, but a group of people, the poorest, most marginalised, most vulnerable people in our own community here in Victoria and Australia and throughout the world, but particularly in our region, in the Asia-Pacific region. So that's the focus we decided on. Now, we had plucked out of thin air. We had a great capacity here through our history in HIV, for example,
yep.
in harm reduction with respect to drug use, reduce the impacts of harm associated with drugs, including infectious diseases, and other infectious diseases in particular that had been a focus of the Institute. But this was an opportunity to pull it together for a specific purpose. So now our Institute's mission is to improve the health of the poor and vulnerable. And that's, you know, really changed things for us. We look at everything through that prism.
Mm-hmm.
And so it doesn't have to be a particular discipline. It has to make a difference to those groups. And we are pretty much the richest country in the world, but we have our own very marginalised groups.
We do.
And some not so obviously marginalised, but young people, for example.
Yeah.
And that are at they're the most vulnerable, apart from the very old. It's the most vulnerable group in Australia now,
yeah.
sort of teenagers and early 20s group. But also much more obvious and dramatic instances of whether they be prisoners or ex-prisoners or injecting drug users or sex workers or whatever it might be in our society. Sometimes we think it's very marginalised, but, you know, hepatitis C, for example, a disease we care about,
yeah.
which is thought to be an infection largely of a marginalised group. Well, in Australia, we have 300,000 people with hepatitis C.
Wow.
It's a very large number. It's going to quickly become, as it has done in other developed countries, the number one cause of liver transplantation. So I'm not making a sort of inappropriate push to work on marginalised populations around it being central to the health of us all,
yeah.
but that is in fact the case.
Yeah,
you know, it's justified to look and to address the health of a whole community, no matter what. But we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that you don't have to look into these things far to recognise that these things impact on us all.
Yeah,
and
somebody very famous said something about you. You know, how you treat the poorest and the most vulnerable gives you a good insight into the character of a society or a man or.
There's no question, absolutely no question about that, whether you're talking about the microcosm of a family, you know,
mm-hmm.
It's not a question in the family that the person who is better off looks after the one who's having a hard time.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that extends to society too, whether it be our own local society or to the world. And that's very much our philosophy, completely non-judgmental,
mm-hmm.
And just looks at supporting those who haven't been so lucky, both because it's the humanitarianly right thing to do,
yes,
but also because whatever prism you look at it through, if you look at it from a selfish point of view, it's still the right thing to do. It still creates an economically better world, a safer world, a world in which you as the donor would be healthier.
Yeah.
That's not the justification that we use here at the Institute, but you can use it.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking here at the highest level in foreign aid, for example, and foreign aid in health. You know, the world 40 years ago, 40% of it was in the extremely poor category.
Yes.
40% of the world lived on less than $1.25 US a day. It's now 15%.
Yeah.
And aid has delivered that. Aid, especially in health, through better water, better hygiene, sanitation, and of course childhood vaccines. And, you know, they've delivered that through, for example, child survival.
Yeah.
You know, child under five mortality's gone from 20 million to 7 million over that same time frame. And the population growth of the world, of course, has gone up, so not even factoring that in.
Yeah.
These are huge success stories which have benefited us all, not mm-hmm. just, of course, those directly impacted. Makes the world safer, it makes the world better. Every year, despite all you'll see, the world is actually getting better. And that's what's happened over the last 30 or 40 years. And that paradigm of the better off, wealthier, supporting those who are less fortunate and less wealthy is what's delivered that. But mm-hmm. primarily what's delivered that is innovations in health.
That sounds like a perfect place to stop. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Kate.